and I bought a little bottle of water, which is 500 mils, cost 25 rand. And I go like, how expensive is it to fill a bath? Okay. It's a hell of a lot of money. Okay. You'd be outside, you know, in the rain with your bar of soap if you kind of paid for that retail.
Our sponsor for this week is Xero, X-E-R-O. They are an accounting software package designed for self-made businesses. And I'll tell you a little bit about it later on. Mark, good morning. How are you?
And top of the morning to you. I am extraordinarily well as we find ourselves between two long weekends. This is just like a work gap week. Okay.
Yes. We're going it's an irritating interregnum between the holidays.
Okay. Yeah.
Listen, I wanted to ask you a question. Are you a financial titan?
Hell no. I don't even know what that means, but
I think you're a bit of a financial titan. You're not a.
Thank you. I better arm myself up to the teeth. What is the Oxford definition of a titan? Eh? No, I'm not. But why?
No. I was just thinking about Marcus Oester and his. Apparently, it's bad to say he committed suicide. The modern terminology is he died by suicide, which actually I think is right. Anyway. Marcus Oester died by suicide last week, and it's kind of shocking, horrible. It sort of like rocks you on your heels, you know, even though you sort of know it's always a possibility and it does happen. Anyway, he was described as a financial titan, and in a lot of the press over the weekend, you know, spoke about him in quite glowing terms. And I sort of wondered about the human interpretation in suicide, how it's a terrible thing to malign the dead. But it's even worse to malign people who have died by suicide. But, you know, you need to keep a grip. The guy was a crook, you know. So, and he cost a whole bunch of pensioners a lot of money. Yeah. So, you know, you do need to keep that in mind, I guess. It's hard.
Yeah, our kind of 50,000 shareholders lost extraordinary amounts of money. And do we play the ball or do we play the man? You know, and suicide does rock everyone because you kind of contemplate the mindset you have to find yourself into. Approach such a thing, you know. What level of desperation, or have you actually run out of all kinds of options? I don't think I've got the courage to do it, but it's not courage, it's some other mixture that only those who've been there know, and we'll never find out. And it's horrible, and that's that. What I see though is, how did this exist in a sophisticated financial market? How did, you know, because we have any number of evils emerging in ecosystems, only ones that permit them to grow and to feed. And so there were mechanisms and markets and audited accounts and stock exchange compliances and people and all sorts of people came together and to connive purposefully and knowingly to create money at the expense of others where there was no value. And that is the mortal sin we need to address, if that's not the wrong term for selling it to money. Yeah.
I really think the problem, the real root problem, arose a very long time ago when I was quite a junior journalist. A friend of mine sent me a report.
Last week.
yes. No, strangely enough, quite a long time ago, that had been written by a financial analyst to say he didn't believe Steinhoff's numbers. It was essentially and Steinhoff objected sort of violently. The finance house, in an act of, you know, supreme cowardice, withdrew the report. And of course, it was all secret because analysts' reports, brokers make money out of these things. They don't like them to go public. And I wrote about it, you know. No one cared.
Well, I read your piece,
We didn't realize it, but that was, in fact, a crossroads. And if people had taken a little bit more interest at that point, things could have turned out differently. I also think there's one other thing, and that is, you know, people commit financial crimes because they think they can get away with them. Or they think that if they get caught, the sanctions are not going to be too harsh. You know, that's basically, you know, the formula behind committing of most crimes. But in the case of financial crimes, it's incremental. So you do something a little bit wrong, you get away with it. You're doing something a little bit more wrong, you get away with it. And then eventually you get caught in a trap. You know, you can go further down into the depths, you know. So quite often people who are not necessarily in different circumstances wouldn't be considered crooks end up in that category, you know, just because a sequence of events took place. And I think that's a little bit what happened to him.
Yeah.
This is my guess, but we don't know.
that's at the root cause of all developing corruption. Is it starts with a little envelope here or a little bit of information there, and
yeah, small money,
and you know, red light. If it was unearned, if you find yourself in an unearned wealth opportunity, know that it's wrong, and know that you'll get caught, and know that eventually you'll need more and more of that substance. It's a drug, you know, which translates into undeserved virtue and standing in the community and all of these kinds of things. And it has no foundation to it, and it's not enduring. And so you need more and more and more. Eventually, the watch you bought isn't the biggest in the world, and the number of horses you own isn't enough. And it's a relative performance thing, and it's got no foundation. So it destroys you.
Yeah,
it's a disease. Okay, and so it's to be avoided. But I think it comes like this. I'm going to try and give a one-minute summary of what happened. So, you know, John and Mary live across the road in Boksburg, and their houses, they bought one house for 400,000 rand. And Mary walks across the road and says, John, I'll give you R1 million for your house. And he says, are you mad? No, I'll give you R1 million for your house. But here's the condition. You must give me 1.2 million rand for mine. He goes, okay, there we go. And they keep going until both houses have traded at about 3 million rand each. Okay. And then they go, let's put one of them on the market. Okay. And then they put one of them on the market, and then it sells for 300. And then an old school friend of John's, you know.
Right.
Gary comes walking down the street, and he goes, what? That house, man, it's worth 400,000 now, you know? And he says, no, man, it's worth 300,000. And then here's the final trick, particularly when you've got currency and exchange control, is you find an asset that's easier to make than money. Okay, so you have shares, and the value of those shares become currency. And the exchange rate for your currency is better than the rand-euro exchange rate to buy foreign assets. You add all that together and you've got... Fine off. Okay. That's my deep financial analysis right there for you. Yeah. But it's true of all corruption, Tim. It's true of all corruption.
Yeah.
It will never satisfy you. Money in and of itself is a terrible thing. Okay. It is. It will never give you peace.
No, I couldn't help noticing that in the seizing of Marcus Huerta's assets, you know, there were five luxury cars, right? That's just for him, right? His wife, she's got her own cars, and the girlfriend's got her own cars, and the polo ponies and stuff like that.
One can never have too much transport in these uncertain times.
Yes. Four. Five? No, we're outside of reality. So let me tell you a little bit about the sponsor of this program. As I said before, they are Xero, that's Xero with an X, and they are an accounting software package. The whole idea is to create a savvy small to medium business owner package. It's very intuitive. The whole idea is to combine ease of use with a really comprehensive set of financial tools so that you can present your accounts with expertise and authenticity. Their unique selling point is that they have a real-time access to financial data and seamless integration with a broad range of third-party applications. Signing up for Xero is very simple. You just go to the website, which is xero.com, and choose a plan that fits your business. It's very straightforward. The driving force idea was to revolutionize financial management and offer accessible and manageable solution for business owners everywhere. And Xero has really benefited South African entrepreneurs. It's been a pivotal tool for South African entrepreneurs, provides real-time insights, simplifies compliance, it optimizes business operations. It's like having a financial guide at your side, and it transforms tedious tasks into manageable actions and makes business finance a valuable asset rather than a daunting task. All right. Well, thank you very much to Xero, and on with our show. The other thing that's happened this past week, of course, is that the not-so-honorable Speaker of the National Assembly, Nosasiwe Masibika Nqakula, her home has been raided, and the claim is that she solicited 2.3 million rand from a contractor. It's just extraordinary how these things happen, because, of course, Marcus Huerta was facing a whole bunch of court cases, and the hawks were also about to pounce on him. So, you know, one of my colleagues said to me, you know, I wish there was an election every day.
Exactly. Yeah. This, you know, the question of the week is, will the speaker be silent? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I wish it was an election. I mean, talking about that, now that there are elections looming ahead of us, it's interesting to me how the government has gone out and started inviting everybody in the private sector to join them in all manner of contracts and deals to fix things in public infrastructure, like Transnet is apparently invited, but I haven't seen the actual invites.
Yes.
And in inviting private sector, you know, come and be partners, you know, in our time of worst need, if you will. But then I saw almost next to that bit of news, I saw the news that Eskom said, nah, they don't want to tell us the details of the contract because that's going to really mess with their negotiation. Okay, now, there's a common theme here. Okay, there's a common theme here, which is that opportunistic illegal money is made in dark rooms, not in public stare. Okay, and we demand privately and publicly to see what's going on, don't we?
Well, what do you make of the argument that you ruin your negotiating position as the organization that's contracting out if you reveal the contract value? I mean, there is something in that argument.
Yeah, I don't think you should reveal a contract halfway in its making. I mean, that's just foolish. Okay, but when you have a signed deal and it is contractually binding with parties, then you are obliged, for example, in a listed company, to make that common knowledge. And in fact, you're also obliged when there's sufficient information that could be price sensitive or, you know, consequential to the organization, to warn all the shareholders that there's something cooking in the kitchen, okay? And so those kinds of rules have been carefully crafted not to destroy the deal-making capacity of parties, but to reveal the truth as soon and as lucidly as possible. And that's, I'm not saying you should go and say, hey guys, we're going to announce, we're looking for R5. And they go, what? No, man, announce you've done the deal at X price so that we can pass judgment on its fairness. And then maybe that'll guide you towards such fairness. I don't know.
I don't understand why they don't just do it as an open auction.
No, we don't do tenders, Tim. Tender, no more tenders.
No. An open auction. Which you say before the highest bid is binding, no bottom offer. Because the other thing that's happening, at least, you know, it's a common factor between SAA and Transnet, is that actually government's not very experienced in the process of negotiating these things.
No.
And the negotiations are just a little bit unreal. You know, the SAA bid basically collapsed really because government's demands were higher than the market was willing to bear.
Yeah.
And I was interested to see that the potential bidders for partnering with Transnet are saying, you know, they're just nuts. They want miles more than this is worth. Yeah. They've got to give us something. They've got to give us something over and above to, you know, encourage us, you know, to enter into a relationship with an organization which is transparently a little bit wobbly.
I spent more hours than I'd like to recount when I was in government service trying to get an acceptance of the notion of fair market value, where everyone makes an appropriate margin or an appropriate, you know, risk return is entered into. And it's not where governments are brought up. Governments are brought up in monopolies where they own the asset and the law and can make the rules. Okay. So there is no continuum. There is no test. You know, so they revalue your property tomorrow and you've got to pay higher taxes. You can start a fight and you can start a war, but it's after the event, looking backwards and so on. I mean, this is common cause. There are two different ecosystems trying to come together. One looks for fair market value and it talks to capital with discretion. And the other one is in charge and it says what it wants. There will be no meeting place that is sustainable between such parties. And so we have to find common cause in the room before we start finding common deals in the room. Anyway.
Yeah. That's why I think that, you know, auctions obviate a lot of those problems because they establish, if you've got a sufficient number of bidders, they establish the market value, you know, the fair market value through the bidding process. And if you predetermine that is, you know, that the result is going to be accepted, whatever it is, then you really encourage people to bid because they could get a really good deal. And a lot of things are settled that way, you know?
Yeah, they are. Talking at the retail level, though, it's not a perfect system because, you know, everyone follows the steer. And, you know, I remember listing a company by way of price to be determined at the highest bidder, and it was a manifest failure. I won't remind us all what the company was, in the sense that the price was bid up and bid up and bid up and eventually settled at fair market value, but didn't start there. And so everyone was drawn in you know, to that temptation unwisely. And that is often tulips from Amsterdam, you know. We have a lot of, you know, we have that kind of a risk. It's not a perfect system. What is a workable system is equally informed, common purpose parties coming together to achieve a reasonable and tested outcome. And that requires people who know what they're doing to be talking to people who know what they're doing and to both have some sort of common cause. It's a very complex thing, and I hope we get it right soon. I mean, it starts off, let me say also, I've just come back from being down at the coast for my work week gap, okay, back in Johannesburg. And the water here is an extraordinary issue, okay? Now, what I haven't figured out, and that's what also needs to happen in private-public partnerships, is what are the root causes? Why isn't there water in tap X at address Y? Okay, and is it because there's no rainfall starting there? Is it because the reticulation is bad? Is it because? And only once you've mapped out the root cause and the final solution can you start designing the operating system and costing it to get to the answer. And I don't think we all know these things. We don't know. I don't know the root cause of load shedding.
I can tell you the answer to the water problem in three words.
Go for it.
Fair market value.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem is that for the entire lifetime, a guy who was involved in the water industry told me this. The problem is that people massively, massively undervalue water.
That I can accept.
And what people pay for water is a fraction, a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what it's actually worth. But it's one of those things which is just such a human necessity that governments are forced to step in and people don't pay or don't even think of what they would pay if they didn't have water. And trust me, they would pay a lot. And they do now. And what they're starting to discover now.
I was trying to work out this extrapolated thing. I was at the airport yesterday and I bought a little bottle of water, which is 500 mils, cost 25 rand. And I go like, how expensive is it to fill a bath? Okay. It's a hell of a lot of money. Okay. You'd be outside, you know, in the rain with your bar of soap if you kind of paid for that retail. And of course, supply and demand has driven that pricing structure off the wall. Okay. But I agree with you. Now, here's the role of government in my view. Take a resource like water and make it as affordable as possible. Why? Because it's an input to almost everything and anything that we do, including our survival, okay? Mm. And then have a prosperous nation as a consequence of the supply of necessary inputs at a reasonable price, and you, the government, will benefit from the tax that you can extract from the, you know, the success of their ventures. So I think there's that conundrum as well. It's all too complicated. No wonder we're not in government, Tim. It's far too, you have to be
I know.
Sort all of this stuff out. No. Yeah.
Having said that, the problem is that water is massively undervalued. I don't know whether I would dare, as a politician, ever value it at its fair market value. You know what I mean?
You can't.
And if you don't do that, you can't do that. So where do you actually price it?
You can only do it as part of a composite measure of sustainable input cost for the economy at large and the survival of its people, okay? And you have to then complete the circle. You can't look at water in isolation or electricity in isolation or any of those.
Yeah.
Or any of those. But in South Africa at the moment, there are all these sub-industries. I read this morning, Nogal, that we now have water tanker mafias. Okay.
Yes, now, no. It's quite a big thing, yeah.
So that should tell you that there's a little bit of mispricing and a little bit of a supply-demand dynamic, okay? Because there's a gap, right? And who should fill it? We should fill it structurally as government. You should fill that gap, because it's exactly the gap that you've brought up here. But it's not being filled by them, so the crooks take it. I'm sick of them, okay?
All right, well, let's change the topic quickly to international stuff. Because I just want to marvel a little bit at India. I mean, so Narendra Modi's popularity is sitting at 75% of the Indian population. And that is just extraordinary. And he's going into an election. I mean, imagine going into an election and the opinion polls show that you have a 75% popularity rate.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, Vladimir Putin is more popular.
87.4 or something,
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, there's competition up there at the top end. But still, it is incredible. 900 million people are going to vote pretty soon. It's just amazing.
Look, I think India is a fascinating case study of a huge population, 1.4 billion people, whatever they are, and sort of straddling all the economic classes and so on. But the center seems to be aware, if nothing else. Okay, and if the center is the current government as a proxy, then it seems to me that they are making space for themselves as a player, much bigger than they were before. And so I sit and watch. I mean, I listen to things like Invest India and places like that, and their invitations and their things are intriguing, if not necessary for that size of population. I'm a bit of a fan of what's happening in India, but I'm at quite a distance from the detail. Tim, we're running out of time, so I'm going to give you my number. Okay.
Okay.
And this story was in the Financial Times, no less. That they've been chasing these people, and they broke into their house, and went into their house and their safety deposit boxes, and found 61,000 bitcoins. Okay.
Right.
So I had to sit and pause for a minute and go, like, sorry, how can you find a bitcoin? Okay. And this is, is there a big basket of these things? Because bitcoin is not a physical, it's a digital asset. Anyway, but right, just to give you the number, it's that find would be worth 78 billion rand at today's money. Now, how do you find bitcoin? First of all, yeah, basically what you do is you find a memory stick, okay, that's got a password and allows you to access the Bitcoin. You find, that's all you find? Okay. I mean, you can buy real little Bitcoins, but they're not coins of their own value. They're coins with an embedded digital code that gives you access to the Bitcoin. Yes. Is a fascinating thing. I think it's going to thrive, but I think there are all sorts of beware in investing that what you don't understand flags around it. So that's my number for the week. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, that's a great number. I'm not going to throw away any of my memory sticks ever again.
Bitcoin in there too. Yeah.
Cool, Mark. Have a good short week in between your holidays.
Yeah. You too, man.
Cheers.
This show is part of the Africa Podcast Network,
the biggest pod network on the continent.
For sales inquiries, please contact us at info@africapodcastnetwork.com.